It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Canadian shooter was hoping to travel to Syria and bomb blast kills five in northern Nigeria. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. Canadian authorities say the gunman who shot and killed a Canadian soldier at a war memorial before he was shot and killed in the Parliament building acted alone in Wednesday's shooting rampage. At a news conference Thursday, Canadian officials said the 32-year-old was a Canadian-born citizen who may have also held Libyan citizenship. They said the gunman recently applied for a Canadian passport and was hoping to travel to Syria. Earlier on Thursday, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper pledged to boost the surveillance and detention powers of security forces in an address to the House of Commons.
We'll be vigilant, but we will not run scared. We will be prudent, but we will not panic. And as for the business of government, well, here we are in our seats, in our chamber, in the very heart of our democracy and our work.
Mr. Harper said lawmakers would expedite new powers to encounter the threat of radicals. A bomb has exploded at a bus station in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least five people and wounding 12 others. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the blast late Wednesday in Azare, the town in Bauchi State, has seen multiple attacks by the militant group Boko Haram in the past 6 months, targeting banks, police stations, and schools. A New York City doctor who recently treated Ebola victims in Guinea has been diagnosed with the disease in a New York City hospital. Preliminary test results at the city's Bellevue Hospital on Dr. Craig Spencer are positive. This is VOA News. Heavy fighting continued Thursday between Islamic State militants and Kurdish fighters battling for control of the northern city town of Kobani. VOA correspondent Scott Bob reports on the Turkey side of the border across from Kobani.
Residents in Kobani are telling our contacts here that there has been heavy fighting overnight, and we know that there was some heavy fighting this morning in Kobani. We've heard even at midday fairly heavy firing of mortars, RPGs, possibly heavy machine guns and some lighter weapons. The struggle for the city continues. We are told that the fighters of the Islamic State reportedly tried to take a plain area outside the city. This reportedly is where the airdrops landed. They're also continuing to fight for control of the border crossing and are shelling central and western parts of the city that are under control of the Kurdish militias. We're told there's a great deal of street-to-street fighting, that streets in small areas change hands. Scott Bob, VOA News, across the border from Kobani.
Ukraine's prime minister says Russia may try to disrupt elections Sunday in his homeland and says he's ordered a full security mobilization to prevent what he calls possible terrorist threats. Arseniy Yatsenyuk's comments came Thursday in a meeting in Kiev with top security chiefs and election monitors. Moscow did not immediately respond to the warning. A short while later, Interior Minister Arsen Avakov, who attended the briefing, said 82,000 police officers will provide security on Sunday, including 60,000 assigned directly to polling stations. He also is quoted as saying more than 200 criminal cases alleging electoral violations have been opened. Sunday's elections are the first parliamentary polls since February, when Russia-leaning President Viktor Yanukovych was forced from office after weeks of pro-Western street protests in Kiev. European Union leaders meeting in Brussels have agreed to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 28-nation bloc to at least 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. The deal reached overnight with protracted negotiations in Brussels also includes requirements that renewable energy sources fuel at least 27% of the bloc's energy needs by that date. An existing goal of a 20% emission cut by 2020 already has been met, due in large part to the phase-out of communist-era heavy industry in Eastern Europe. A 23-year-old man is in police custody Thursday after he climbed over a White House fence, prompting a lockdown at the U.S. presidential compound in the second such security breach since a similar September issue. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Health Organization says it is not in favor of a travel ban against Ebola-affected countries in West Africa,
explaining that this would be likely to cause economic hardship and could consequently increase the uncontrolled migration of people from affected countries.
Isabel Notal is WHO's Director of Global Capacities. A group of doctors have called on African leaders to step up in the fight against Ebola. Zimbabwe's First Lady says she wants to succeed her husband, Robert Mugabe. WHO is 90, and Zambia marks 50 years of independence today, Friday.
It's not paradise on earth, but we've done a very commendable job. In fact, Zambia is one of the best-kept secrets anywhere, if you want my opinion, in terms of its peacefulness and its receptiveness to investment, confidence, and so forth.
Guy Scott is Zambia's vice president. Botswana votes in parliamentary and local government elections today, Friday. And Human Rights Watch says migrant domestic workers are trapped and exploited in the United Arab Emirates. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Emergency Ebola Committee of the World Health Organization has again come out against bans on travel and trade with the countries where the virus is wreaking the greatest havoc. As Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva, the committee of experts says this will not stop the spread of Ebola.
The emergency committee declared Ebola a public health emergency of international concern when it held its first session in August. Since then, the epidemic has worsened significantly in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and has spread to Nigeria, Senegal, the United States, and Spain. Latest WHO figures put the number of Ebola cases at 9,936 cases, including 4,877 deaths, all but a few of them in the three West African countries. In its latest assessment of the epidemic released Thursday, the Emergency Committee emphasized the importance of stopping transmission of Ebola within the three main countries as the best way of preventing further international spread. The committee rejected calls for a general ban on international travel or trade as being both ineffective and counterproductive. The WHO Director of Global Capacities, Isabel Nuttall, says the committee stands by its previous recommendation that people who are sick with Ebola or have been in contact with patients in the last 21 days should not leave their countries.
They provided some explanation as to why they wouldn't recommend a general travel ban, explaining that this would be likely to cause economic hardship and could consequently increase the uncontrolled migration of people from affected countries, therefore raising the risk of international spread of Ebola.
The committee also emphasized the need to reduce the isolation and economic hardship of the affected countries by normalizing air travel and the movement of ships. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea have exit screening measures in place at their airports, but a number of countries now have introduced entry screening measures in an effort to keep out Ebola. This includes the United States, which recently had its first imported case of Ebola from Liberia. Dr. Nuttall says little is known about the effectiveness of such a measure and has called for countries implementing entry screening to share their experiences and information.
It was noted by the committee that entry screening may have a limited effect in reducing international spread when added to exit screening. So its advantages and disadvantages should be carefully considered.
The emergency committee also recommended that countries not cancel international meetings and mass gatherings. It said it recognizes these are complex decisions and said they must be decided on a case-by-case basis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
While the Ebola outbreaks in Senegal and Nigeria were recently declared over, transmission of the disease remains persistent and widespread in the three most affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Health experts from countries that have dealt successfully with past Ebola outbreaks tell VOA's Maria Mandialo that the leaders of those currently affected nations must switch their focus in order to start seeing some positive changes.
Senegal and Nigeria have now been declared free of Ebola. And Nigeria's efforts drew praise this week as the country's foreign minister, Aminu Bashir Wali, met with his German counterpart, Frank-Walter Steinmeier.
It's an accomplishment in this neighborhood, and thanks to the Nigerian health system and political awareness that Nigeria ensured it did not contribute to the spread of the virus.
But Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are not as fortunate, according to Lynn Black, a physician and the board chair of an aid organization called Last Mile Health. Black recently returned from Liberia and told a Washington panel discussion the situation is frightening.
We have to reach the religious leaders, the village leaders, so that they will then trust us and help us break the chain of the Ebola spread, because people are starting to hide now. Because you go into an Ebola treatment unit, the community doesn't know what happens to people who go in there.
Other countries have grappled successfully with Ebola in the past, among them Uganda, which has had at least five outbreaks since the year 2000, most recently in 2012. Dr. Francis Omazwa is the executive director at the African Center for Global Health and Social Transformation, and is from Uganda. He says there's much to be learned from the way his country has handled Ebola.
You need to win the trust of the population. Lesson number two, controlling the epidemic will be done by the communities themselves, being able to identify those who are suspected to have the disease and to refer them to centers for tests, isolation, and treatment.
Another Ugandan doctor, Margaret Mungerera, is president of World Medical Association. She says while the international community has done a lot to help, the African leaders need to be the face of the epidemic.
Decisions are being made outside the countries concerned, and they're being, you know, they're not allowing them to be the ones to make the decisions that need to be done.
Despite the current Ebola crisis, Omazwa says there is some good news, pointing out in a new book that more than a dozen African countries have made recent strides in their healthcare systems. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Zambians are celebrating their country's golden anniversary today, Friday. The country gained its independence from former colonial power Britain in 1960. Vice President Guy Scott says Zambia is the best-kept secret in Africa when it comes to the country's peacefulness, political stability, and economic performance. However, Zambia is celebrating today without its president, Michael Sata, who is out of the country to seek medical treatment. Vice President Scott tells reporter Peter Clotty that although President Sata will be absent at today's celebration, measures have been put in place to ensure that the event runs smoothly.
I'm on my way now to the to a dinner and then to the stadium, where I imagine there'll be a problem of overcrowding. People are very ready to celebrate. People like to be proud of themselves. People like to be something to make them proud of themselves. And surviving 50 years of quite a lot of instability in this region, without suffering much instability ourselves, and making tremendous progress in social equality and in production, economic growth, and so forth. It hasn't been an easy ride all the way, but I think most people are aware that Zambia has gone forward and is still going forward.
Mr. Vice President, there are several critics who say that Zambia has not been able to rise to the level of its potential after independence due to what they call leaders who have not been able to really marshal the people to really develop the country to the state that they expect. What do you say to that?
Listen, if I ring you up in Washington there and say, I'm going to interview you now about the United States of America, and I hear Republicans who say the Democrats haven't done anything for the last, whatever it is, 8 years, and I told the Democrats who say the Republicans haven't done anything. It's politics. It's democracy. Lots of people are ready to gripe, and be very negative about what's been done. It's not paradise on earth, but it's we've done a very commendable job. In fact, Zambia is one of the best kept secrets anywhere, if you want my opinion, in terms of its peacefulness and its receptiveness to investment confidence and so forth. They're going absolutely mad for us at the moment. It's politics. You don't expect the opposition to say, yes, the government is doing a great job, and nor do you expect the government to spend much time on what the opposition says.
Mr. Vice President, one issue is that the head of state will not be able to participate in this. How are you moving along with this celebration with him not being there?
Well, we're moving along. It's very sad. He's certainly missed the best-loved politician in Zambia. And it's a shame that he should be somewhere else when we're celebrating, as we must. He wouldn't want us to do anything else. And but, I mean, you know, between acting presidents, vice presidents, former presidents, and so forth, we can put on a pretty cool ceremony. And that's what we'll do. I don't think there's any danger of the government coming unstuck over a ceremonial issue.
Guy Scott is Zambia's vice president. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. And you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 24th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's First Lady, Grace Mugabe, who has been on a nationwide Meet the People tour as she prepares to assume the leadership of the Women's League in the ruling ZANU-PF party this December, yesterday told former freedom fighters that she wants to succeed her 90-year-old husband, Robert Mugabe, who has been in power for the last 34 years. Thomas Chiripasi has details.
The First Lady told the war veterans that she summoned to Emazoe Orphanage that she was ready to take over the leadership of the country from her husband, President Robert Mugabe, who turns 91 next year. She, however, did not say whether she would or intends to take over the leadership of the party at ZANU-PF's elective congress slated for December.
If you support Mai Mujuru, you can leave right now, because the moment of truth is now here. What I've been promising to expose, I will do it here today.
In her nationwide rallies that she has been holding since her endorsement by the Women's League, the First Lady has issued verbal attacks widely believed to be targeted at Vice President Joyce Mujuru. In today's address, she went further, mentioning the vice president by name and also calling on her to resign. She accused Mrs. Mujuru and those backing her of planning to remove Mr. Mugabe from office through what she described as a coup.
Mai Mujuru should just resign. You don't seem pleased by what I've just said. So you think it's okay for me to endorse Mai Mujuru as vice president, but it's not okay for me to ask her to resign? Chinotimba, you don't seem pleased by what I said.
Political analyst and director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, Pedzai Ruanya, tells VOA that Mrs. Mugabe does not have presidential ambitions, adding that what she said today was a way of clearing the way for Mnangagwa to take over from her husband.
This statement means that we are close to unlocking the succession debate in ZANU. And it also fundamentally indicates that Mugabe has now settled for Mnangagwa, because the wife of a sitting head of state would not go to the extending of making a pronouncement on a preferred candidate to take a particular position without the authority of the president. But what we are now waiting is a clear and equivocal, unambiguous position by Mugabe himself.
At the December Congress, the First Lady is expected to be elected to the powerful post of Secretary of ZANU-PF's Women's League. This will automatically propel her into the ruling party's supreme decision-making body between Congresses, the Politburo. Reporting from Mazowe, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The executive secretary of Botswana's Independent Electoral Commission says the electoral body is fully prepared to administer credible parliamentary and local government elections today, Friday. Gabriel Siletso said the commission has addressed concerns of opposition political parties about the recently compiled voters list that would be used for the elections. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that the general election would be free, transparent and credible and would meet international standards.
This morning, I can confirm that all the materials have reached our 2,606 polling stations, though it's still too early to tell, certainly, that all of them have received their election materials. But yesterday, Thursday, all the materials had left the constituency headquarters. There could be one or two breakdowns of our vehicles, and in that case, that's why I want to leave at least that window until I have received all the reports from the respective polling station.
Mr. Siletso, how credible do you think this election will be?
As always, our elections are run by men and women of substance, the commissioners and the secretariat of the commission. The people we engage as poll staff are people who are accountable and indeed love their country. They cannot sacrifice their country for anything. So I'm confident that the elections will certainly be credible. And the elections in our country are run based on the legal framework that is in place. So, you know, it's not a question of what one wishes to see, but what the law dictates for them.
There were concerns by some opposition politicians complaining about the elections, the voter register and all that. Was your organization able to address some of these concerns that you think will pave way for a credible vote?
Indeed, I can confirm that because, like I said, elections in Botswana are run in accordance with the law. And we even allowed that political parties be used as inspection points. So that I mean, we could bring the rolls for inspection as close as it is humanly possible to the voter. And I can tell you that in our roll doesn't have that many mistakes to stop the election and probably even discredit the quality of our election.
Gabriel Siletso is the executive secretary of Botswana's Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Gaborone. Migrant domestic workers in the United Arab Emirates are beaten, exploited, and trapped in forced labor situations, according to a Human Rights Watch HRW report published on Thursday. Analysts say that across the Middle East, living conditions for migrant domestic workers, most of them from Asia and Africa, are very poor. Sela Hennessy reports for VOA from London.
Marilee Brua from the Philippines was once a domestic worker in the United Arab Emirates.
Sabi niya sa akin na, kasi nagreklamo ako, madam, walang pagkain.
She says she once complained to her madam that there was no food for her to eat, and she was told, you're just something I bought, so don't complain. You don't have the right to complain because we bought you. The Human Rights Watch report published Thursday documents widespread abuse of immigrant domestic workers in the UAE. The majority are from Africa and Asia. Rathna Begum from HRW says many of the women who migrate to UAE do not know what's in store for them.
Tens of thousands of women every single year migrate to the United Arab Emirates. They say goodbye to their families and their very young children, and they hope that they will be securing salaries for their families' futures. But they have no guarantee that they will end up with such salaries or even good working conditions.
Domestic workers who were interviewed for the report described not being paid, not having rest periods or time off, being confined in their employers' homes, and working days of up to 21 hours. They described being deprived of food and reported psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. Many said their employers treated them like animals. HRW says the domestic workers' rights will not improve until the UAE's visa sponsorship system, known as kafala, changes. The system requires all unskilled workers to have a sponsor within the UAE who's responsible for their visas and legal status. Begum says that means workers cannot move to a new job before their contracts end without the employer's consent, trapping workers in abusive conditions.
They are not allowed to transfer employers, even if they are being abused or receiving far less than what they were promised. They are trapped to that single employer.
Audrey Guichon from Anti-Slavery International says responsibility for protecting the migrant workers does not lie solely with the host country. She says labor-sending countries need to do more to protect the workers against deceptive recruitment practices and to educate their populations about the possible conditions overseas. For a long time, domestic work was not considered a profession, she says, and so workers have not had adequate legal protection. According to HRW, at least 146,000 female migrant domestic workers from countries such as the Philippines, Indonesia, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Ethiopia work in the UAE. Sayla Hennessy for VOA News, London.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's post. Here is Mark Ohoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with cricket. Uganda beat defending champions Nepal by 20 runs at the start of their campaign at the Pepsi ICC World Cricket League Division 3 in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia on Thursday. Today, Friday, Uganda plays Singapore before the United States of America on Sunday. Turning to football, Togo is the world's most improved national men's team, while Burkina Faso and Armenia have each slipped by the widest margin in the world, according to the FIFA rankings released in Zurich, Switzerland on Thursday. Algeria has climbed to 15th place in the world ranking, their highest ever in their football history. They top the African chart. Ivory Coast are 23rd, Tunisia 31st, Cape Verde Islands 33rd, Ghana 35th, Egypt 38th, Cameroon 40th, Senegal 41st, Nigeria 42nd, and Togo 52nd. In Namibia, the curtains come down at the Telecom and Namibia Mobile African Women's Championships when Nigeria Super Falcons play Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township in Windhoek tomorrow Saturday. Prior to the final, South Africa engage Ivory Coast in the bronze medal playoff. The winner will join Nigeria and Cameroon at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Elsewhere, the Democratic Republic of Congo's AS Vita host Algeria's Entente Setif in the opening leg of the Orange African Champions League final in Kinshasa on Sunday. Meanwhile, hosts Zambia play Ivory Coast in a men's friendly international in Lusaka tomorrow Saturday. Staying in Lusaka, Zambian head of state President Michael Sata is set to honor the Zambian team that won the 2012 Orange Africa Cup of Nations on the occasion of Zambia's 50th independence anniversary on Sunday. Finally, over 3,000 athletes line up for the Standard Chartered Nairobi Marathon in the Kenyan capital on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday. Our listener mail for this Friday morning comes from Umiakoka Maurice of Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Anambra State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, please permit me to use this medium to commend the National Assembly of Nigeria for restoring the autonomy of local governments in Nigeria during the just concluded constitutional amendment process. The way and manner that the various state governments stifle democratic activities in the local government system in Nigeria negate the principle of true federalism. Presently, local government chairmen are hired and fired in utter violation of Section 7 of the 1999 Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria." We thank you, Umiakuka Maurice of Federal Polytechnic in Oko, Anambra State, Nigeria, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. And that is it for this Friday, October 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America. I'll be back.